Okay, final session for today. I'm very happy to welcome Professor Carol Ernst, who has literally just walked off of an airplane after a long transatlantic flight. But here he is, and please, we will begin the final session, which has yogic and Ayurvedic qualities, so perhaps all of us will now revive. Please.
Well, thank you very much, David, and thanks to the organizers for bringing me here. Fabrizio Speziali and I are working together on a project which is meeting starting on the day after tomorrow, the Perso Indica project. And so what I'm going to present to you is the results of my investigations of a particularly difficult problem of unraveling a series of translations of a text which does not appear to survive as an independent entity, but which has many later avatars, if I can use the expression. And I'm going to summarize the textual history of this, and then I'd like to explore a couple of the hermeneutical strategies that are found in particularly the last and most widely spread of these translations, the one which in fact has several illustrated copies as indicated in the slide. This is from the 16th century translation by the Sufi master of the Shatari order, Muhammad Ghaus, 1550. The original illustrations for that one were commissioned by Jahangir in around 1600, and so there's a remarkable visual history which I won't be able to go into today. So as an overview of the major divisions of the text, while I highlighted a work which is referred to as the Amritakunda and is given a very prominent role as being the source text, there clearly is an overlap with another textual tradition which is referred to as Kamaru Panchashika, is best we can reconstruct the title. As often is the case, the Persian script does not help us very confidently to reconstruct Indic terms. And so I'll be showing you in a very brief summary, the interaction of these two textual traditions. I won't use words like pollution or contamination, although it's interesting to see the way in which they keep interacting. And then I have identified four different translations of the text into Persian, again, drawing upon both, but highlighting the Amritakunda. So here is a quick look at the Kamaru Panchashika, which we know from a single complete manuscript which was collected in Persia by Pietro della Valle in the early 17th century. We know it's been circulating in Persia since the 14th century. The complete text has 20 chapters, and it covers a variety of material, principally divination by breath, numerous spells, which they're not called mantras, they're referred to by a Persian term, afsun, which means a magical spell, and quite a few recipes for summoning yoginis for numerous powerful benefits. It's a highly composite text, which has at least four different beginnings, and it refers separately to a work which is entitled either the 32 or 84 verses of Kamakhya, a deity who plays a very important role in all of these texts. And there also are lengthy transcriptions of Hindi verses into Persian script, which probably as a result of several generations of copying are bafflingly difficult to interpret. But in any case, we know that this text was circulating probably around 1300 because excerpts from it were included in a Persian encyclopedia somewhat after 1300, which was very well known. And that was called the Nafayas al-Funun, or the Select Sciences. It's also quoted substantially the same materials in a encyclopedia prepared for the Mughal Emperor Humayun, and also in a 19th century work compiled in Iran, the Kashf al-Sanaya, which also contains interesting information about European sciences. So it's a quite eclectic work. There was a 6-chapter abridgment of this, which was widely circulated. And it had several different titles, such as The Science of Breath and Imagination, or The Science of Mind Reading. And we've identified a number of different recensions of this, including one that was acquired by E.G. Brown in Persia in 1880 from a manuscript copied about 80 years previously. And this Persian text was then rendered into Arabic at some unknown time. There's a single manuscript of that. And just to show you a little surprise, this text had a wide readership in Persia up until the present day. And the 6-chapter version was included in an anthology of a completely eclectic nature by Mullah Ahmad al-Naraqi, a work called The Khazayin, or Treasuries. And it was edited by a prominent contemporary cleric in Iran, Hasanzadeh Amoli, who is a specialist in the occult arts. And the text is available on his website. So this is kind of a surprising indication of the circulation of the text in Persia from the 14th century up until the present. Now, to switch to the Amritakunda, I put an asterisk on this because we have not identified an independently existing text in Hindi or Sanskrit, although its contents are familiar from many other documents. We have an Arabic version of this, which claims to have been translated on the frontier of Bengal in 1212, a claim which I find to be hard to credit because of its remarkably early nature, the liminal status of Bengal in the early 13th century, and also the highly fictionalized version of the way that the translation is said to have taken place. Briefly, what happened was, as soon as the Turks conquered eastern Bengal, a yogi from Kamarupa, Assam, decided to go into the city of Pandua and challenge one of the Muslim scholars to a debate. The debate, which is reported in the text, is described entirely in lines from the Quran and has a very interesting fictional take on the notion of conversion. The yogi loses the debate, and then he informs the jurist who defeated him that he has a very interesting text. And then there's a complicated story about it gets translated into Persian and then into Arabic, and then a second editor comes along, and it is called the Mirror of Meanings, or Mirat al-Ma'ani, and it was circulating certainly by the 15th century in Arabic. Now, I wanted just to draw your attention, for those of you who are not familiar with this, to its highly complex structure, because it contains elements in the frame story which are quite diverse, including the famous Hymn of the Pearl, or Hymn of the Soul, from the Apocryphal New Testament, the Gnostic Acts of Thomas. And it purports to be, interestingly enough, the song which the Apostle Thomas sang while he was imprisoned in India. But it's a Gnostic myth of the descent of the soul into the material world. This is then amplified by an allegorical depiction of the internal and external senses according to the Aristotelian psychology of Ibn Sina in a text by the Persian philosopher Sohrawardi. So there's some other material brought in from the Brethren of Purity. In other words, a great deal of material was inserted, as much as 30% of the text is of non-Indian origin. And these would have served to some readers as a hermeneutical guide to understanding the contents of the yogic and other Indian material in the text. And there are two different recensions of it, one of which was more de-Indianized and more Islamicized. Subsequently, this was translated into Ottoman Turkish. Both of the recensions are available in manuscripts, and one of them was printed in Istanbul in 1912. And we'll be hearing about that at our conference in a couple of days. There's a Judeo-Arabic version and several Persian translations. So this is the other half of the picture. But several manuscripts of the Mirat al-Ma'ani contain the name of the Kamaru Panchashika as well as the Amrita Kunda. So, and it's also clear that some of the divination practices and summoning of goddesses in particular are common to both. So now here's the outline of the translations, and my numbering got a little bit messed up here, but the three translations with one additional recension of the second one, I think I can now be pretty clear about the way that they are related to one another. The Hauzul Hayat, which is a near translation of Amrita Kunda, in other words, the pool of life. If we added one more word, which is found in certain sources, water, the pool of the water of life, that would be a good approximation of the pool of nectar. And this is a symbol which occurs very prominently in the text. And I'll come back to its contents and its methods. There's a second one called Ayn al-Hayat in a single manuscript. We find that title, but it's a useful clarification of the difference between them. And I'm going to read you the comments of a reader who was unhappy with the textual tradition and was revising it into a separate recension, which we know he composed in the city of Ahmednagar. But the most popular of them is the Bahrul Hayat, the ocean of life, and actually that conveys something of the size of this particular effort, because the ocean of life, the Bahrul Hayat, is 4 to 5 times as long as the original Arabic text. And so the question of what the additional material is quite interesting. It was translated into Deccani Urdu in the 19th century, and there was a commentary on the Hauzul Hayat written in Patna in the 19th century. So we can see that this was a popular text which continued to be the subject of discussion for quite a long time in many different regions of India as well as Persia. And the last thing, the Bahrul Hayat has a complicated relationship with the original, because it is clear from the repetition of certain formulas that Muhammad Ghaus had the Hauzul Hayat in front of him when he was composing the Bahrul Hayat. But at the same time, he seems to have had access to an earlier recension of the Arabic translation than we can find anywhere else. And I can explain that if anyone has any questions. It quotes some additional material, which is clearly from the Kamaru Panchashika, but very explicitly, Muhammad Ghaus says that he spent several years living with yogis in eastern Bihar, and he is amplifying this material with oral traditions and practices which he has personally collected. And as an example of that, whereas the Arabic version of the Amritakunda has 5 asana postures, in Muhammad Gauth's translation, we have 22, which are supplied with names which do not exactly correspond to the names found in the Hatha Yoga text that we are familiar with. One of the features of these multiple translations is that the later ones consistently are critical of the corruption of the mantras. They were, in effect, early text editors who were demonstrating their unhappiness by producing new editions. But this was an enterprise that was not destined to be very successful. Some of the translation strategies that are found here are mantras are given translations. So the term Om is rendered in the Arabic as with the Arabic formula Ya Rab, O Lord, which is in effect a theologically defined prayer formula. Muhammad Gauth doubles up on this and he adds a second divine name. These are the names that are used in the Sufi zikr meditation. So it's Ya Rab, Ya Qadir, O Lord, your all-powerful one. From a philological point of view, I would venture to say that these translations are nonsensical, but they evince a very interesting strategy of familiarization and sort of structural equivalence. The biggest differences in this text are that the 9th chapter is the one where we had the largest treatment of the yogini goddesses, who in the Arabic text are referred to as spiritual beings, not as deities. And there was a very large space for spiritual beings in the imaginaire of Muslim societies from the Mediterranean to India, in terms of the jinn, in terms of talismans, in terms of a whole world of the unseen. And so they were more or less invited into that by the translators, the early translators. But they disappear from most of the manuscripts that we have, where the 9th chapter is often reduced to a single paragraph, or in the case of Muhammad Gauth, is completely replaced with a series of Sufi practices which have nothing to do with Indian traditions. Whether this is due to an antipathy towards polytheism, or because the yoginis were dropped at an early stage and were simply not visible to readers at a later phase of the transmission, is hard to say. The last element that I wanted to highlight before I go back talk about some of the textual practices is the 10th chapter. And I'm talking to an audience here that I feel is very expert in the materials that I'm looking at, because what we have here is a cosmogony which begins with material that is fairly easily located in Islamic discourses. A rather impressive and beautiful depiction of a voice and an echo, which are the beginning of the creation of the world. But about halfway through, it shifts from Quranic into Puranic mode. And we have, the shift takes place with quotations from the Quran on water as the basis of the earth, of the creation of the entire universe. And then we suddenly are in a world where the water is forming a lotus tree, which is shaken by an unnamed entity numerous times to form the different worlds. A female figure appears, and then on her hand appear several rubies, which then turn into Brahma, Vishnu, and Shiva. And if there's anyone here who would like to look at a translation of this text and help me to try to decode some of the sources in the Puranic or Sankhya sources, I would be most grateful. So I'm looking at Sylvia to think. but let me give you a couple of the textual remarks, and I think that will probably be enough to pique your curiosity. Yes, so this is kind of a commentary. I'll run through several of the justifications that the writers give us for producing these different versions. As I mentioned, there's a constant complaint that the words get jumbled. And so, for instance, we know that they are introducing the word alak as an important phoneme for Indian practices, but it regularly gets transformed into the word Allah by scribes whose hands have habits that are very strong. And so one has to restore that by comparison with the texts that have been more scrupulous. And this raises interesting issues about editing and variants and so forth. I would also pause to remark that these different translations, mostly with the exception of Mohammed Gauss, they are emanating from people who are completely unknown, where we are given names, even supposedly a patron of one of the translations. It is completely impossible to locate these in any historical sources that we have. So the decentralization of this type of reading practice seems to be fairly clear. So here is a comment by Mohammed Gauss on the earlier translations. The earlier translator wrote the unintelligible Indian words, which we can read as the mantras, in a mixed up fashion so that the minds of men and imaginations of colleagues did not reach from their words through their meanings to the goal. This faqir, Muhammad Gauss refers to himself, went to Kamarup and spent several years in the study and realization of this science to the necessary degree, and he put it into practice. After some time, it occurred to him, and several residents of the town requested, that because in this book most of the sciences are established, but most of the words have become unintelligible, he should completely correct it. Therefore, having heard it from the tongue of the yogis, he put it into writing, and he named the book Bahrul Hayat, The Ocean of Life. So this is a process of collective discussion about texts which have become unintelligible because of the scribal copying process. Now, I want to read you a passage where Mohammed Gauss talks about some of the most difficult problems. He is a very careful writer. We know that one of his other works, he redrafted it after 20 years, and he demanded that all of his disciples throw away their old copies and acquire new ones. The text of the Bahrul Hayat has quite a few cross-references. In other words, this is a topic we will discuss in Chapter 8, or as we said earlier, in other words, it shows the signs of a fairly careful writer. And it's filled with Quranic quotations and hadith sayings from the Prophet Muhammad, which serve as hermeneutical signposts for the reader. But he runs into places where there are problems. So, for instance, the notion of the spirit as created by God, a Quranic doctrine, sits uneasily next to the concept of the eternal Atma. So here is a comment that he inserts in the text. The Siddha Jogis say, he always uses the pronunciation Jogi, we are in agreement with the realized dervishes on the essence of spirit. And insofar as things descend, appear, and progress, this is true. But in recognizing reality, they, the Sufis, have left out the link. The order of Jogis has found the link. They preserve and follow it because from the link of the body, knowledge of reality appears. So this material, which is admittedly in theological conflict with Islamic teachings, nevertheless has an empirical, verifiable reality, and that's why he is justifying it. Another interesting feature of manuscripts, aside from all of the fascinating minutiae of copying and editing, is the binding, the packaging. The oldest illustrated copy, and you can see this on the left, the Chester Beattie Library has the one which was, we believe, commissioned by Jahangir while he was sitting around in Allahabad waiting for Akbar to die. And there are two other copies, one which is now at the University of North Carolina and the other one in Hyderabad in Salar Jung, which clearly all have the same illustration program. But interestingly, the Chester Beattie copy, the oldest one, which was, we believe, commissioned by Jahangir, has a beautiful binding. And the catalogers report that there is a Quranic verse repeated four times in the cover. But they did not indicate what the Quranic verse was. I was recently able to determine this, and it is from the Quran, "None shall touch it but the purified." This is a verse which is commonly included on the cover of Qurans. And so this raises an interesting question. Was this applied to the Bahrul Hayat out of respect? By accident? Or in irony? Thinking of Jahangir, I think a bit of respect and a bit of irony, probably both were present. So this is an overview of the complicated material that has been circulating under the rubric of being translated from two mysterious texts of India. And what's also striking is that when they introduce the translation, both the Amrita Kunda and the Kamarupa Panchashika are reported to be the most important texts in India that everyone is familiar with. a claim which seems slightly exaggerated since we have no indication of their presence under those titles. So I've been looking at this problem for over 30 years. This is an intricate tradition in which there is a host of pseudonymous rabbit holes that can distract you. For instance, we have 80 copies of the Arabic manuscripts, 80 manuscripts of this text, which is kind of remarkable. Over half of them are attributed pseudonymously to the Sufi metaphysician Ibn Arabi. This is not feasible from an analytical point of view, but I've been in correspondence with a sheikh who used to live in Damascus, I don't know if he's still there, who regards it as an authentic work of Ibn Arabi and who uses it in his spiritual practice. There was a time when Orientalists cheerfully assumed that everything exotic and mystical originates in India, and that Sufism did not fit their view of rigid, austere Islam, so it must be derived from an Indian source. This particular tradition is the most widespread evidence of the interaction of Sufis and Muslims in general with material relating to yoga and other techniques of spiritual practice. And I think it is impossible to use this particular text as a fulcrum to lift the entire tradition of Islamic mysticism. I think in practice, many of these texts were more widely used in circles who were interested in divination and predicting the future. We are told in the divination techniques that if their breath is coming from the right nostril, it's a good day to see the king. If it's coming from the left nostril, wait until next week. These are matters of practical import rather than theological subtlety. So, in any case, I think having the track of these different translations allows us to see the multiple ways in which Muslims have sampled and appropriated and reinterpreted the yogic material which is packaged under these names. But it will not solve all the problems of intercivilizational exchange and interpretation. So I think I'll leave it at that.